Welcome to Bayes by Bayes, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, when most people think of Parkinson's disease, they immediately picture the motor symptoms, right?
Right, yeah. The resting tremors, the rigidity.
Exactly, the slow shuffling changes in how someone walks.
But that standard clinical picture, that's what we usually use to diagnose the condition. But from a biological standpoint, those physical tremors are actually, they're at the very end of a surprisingly long silent process.
Yeah, and that silent phase is what we are exploring in our deep dive today, because it is just fascinating. I mean, long before any motor issues appear, sometimes more than 10 or even 15 years earlier, people can develop a cluster of really surprising non-motor symptoms.
Oh, absolutely. Things you wouldn't necessarily connect to Parkinson's at first.
Right. We are talking about chronic unexplained constipation, or a sudden complete loss of the sense of smell, and something called REM sleep behavior disorder, which is particularly striking.
Yeah, that one is intense. Because normally when you enter REM sleep, your brain essentially paralyzes your muscles so you don't act out your dreams.
But in these patients, that normal paralysis just vanishes. They physically act out their dreams, sometimes shouting or kicking in their sleep.
It really represents a profound shift in how the nervous system operates. And the crucial detail for our discussion is the timeline. I mean, these disruptions are happening a full decade before the dopamine-producing neurons in the brain begin to visibly fail and trigger those hallmark tremors.
Which brings us to a compelling question. What is actually happening in the brain during that silent decade? To understand it, we have to zoom way in.
Right, past the brain tissue, past the individual neurons themselves.
Yeah, all the way down to the microscopic level. Specifically, we're looking at these tiny hair-like structures on the surface of our brain cells.
They're called primary cilia, and while they might sound like, you know, minor cellular appendages, their role in communication is massive. They basically act as highly sensitive antenna for the cell.
I was thinking about this earlier, and imagine a brain developing Parkinson's is like a bustling city. The buildings in this city are the vital dopamine neurons.
Okay, I like that analogy.
Right. But long before any of those buildings start collapsing, the city's cell towers, these primary cilia, quietly lose power. It is an invisible cellular blackout. And the question we're diving into today is, could this quiet blackout of the cellular antenna be the universal trigger for Parkinson's disease?
That is the big question.
And before we get into the weeds, today we celebrate the work of researchers at Stanford University and Baylor College of Medicine, alongside the Aligning Science Across Parkinson's Network and HHMI, who have advanced our understanding of the cellular pathways underlying Parkinson's disease.
It's an incredible collaborative effort.
It really is. So let's set the stage for this scientific mystery. For decades, researchers have known that Parkinson's disease is characterized by two main pathological features. First, the progressive death of dopaminergic neurons in a specific region of the midbrain called the substantia nigra.
Right, and those are the neurons that govern our movement coordination. Their loss is what ultimately causes the tremors.
Yeah, and the second feature is the accumulation of toxic protein clumps throughout the brain. Specifically, a naturally occurring protein called alpha-synuclein starts to misfold.
It aggregates into these dense, toxic structures known as Lewy pathology. And these clumps spread between neurons, gumming up their internal machinery, disrupting their function, and eventually driving cell death.
Now, in the vast majority of Parkinson's cases, around 85 to 90%, we don't know exactly what triggers that protein to misfold in the first place. We call those idiopathic cases. But the remaining 10 to 15% of cases are strongly linked to known genetic mutations, right?
Exactly. And two of the most studied are mutations in a gene called LRRK2 and mutations in a gene called GBA1. Historically, studying those specific genetic cases has been our most reliable window into the underlying mechanics of the disease.
Right.
For instance, in previous studies looking specifically at the LRRK2 mutation, researchers found something highly localized. The mutation was causing those primary cilia, the cell towers, to break down and disappear.
Okay, let's unpack this, because these cilia aren't just sitting there for decoration. They are essential for a process called hedgehog signaling.
Yeah, hedgehog signaling. It's a huge deal in biology.
And from what I understand, this hedgehog signaling pathway is basically a distress beacon, or like a maintenance request.
Uh-huh.
When the antenna is working, it receives signals that prompt specific support cells in the brain to produce neurotrophic factors.
Right. These are specialized proteins with names like GDNF, NRTN, and BDNF.
Are these primary cilia essentially calling in like survival supply drops to keep the dopamine neurons alive?
Exactly. That's exactly what they're doing. And to understand the gravity of that, we have to look at how demanding a dopamine neuron actually is. These neurons have incredibly long, complex branches, or axons, that require massive amounts of energy and structural support to maintain.
So they can't just survive on their own?
No, they cannot survive in a vacuum. Those neurotrophic factors you mentioned, like GDNF, which stands for glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor, they are the vital survival signals that sustain those massive axonal networks.
So the dopamine neurons really rely on their neighbors?
They absolutely do. And if the primary cilia on those neighboring support cells are broken, the hedgehog signaling cascade physically cannot happen. I mean, the receptor for the signal is located on the antenna itself.
No antenna means no signal reception.
Right. The support cells stop producing the neurotrophic factors, the supply drops cease, and without that critical life support, the dopaminergic neurons gradually lose their structural integrity and die.
Wow. So the scientific community knew that the genetic LRRK2 mutations break these antennas.
Mm.
But the huge lingering mystery was about the alpha-synuclein protein clumps, right? The toxic Lewy pathology that defines the vast majority of all Parkinson's cases. Did alpha-synuclein break the antenna too?
What's fascinating here is that for a long time, the field viewed the LRRK2 genetic mutations and the alpha-synuclein protein aggregations as potentially distinct, entirely separate pathways that merely resulted in the same disease.
Really? Just two different roads to the same destination.
Yeah. And this view was reinforced by the fact that about 30% of patients with the LRRK2 mutation don't even show classical Lewy body pathology in their brains after they pass away.
Oh, wow. That creates a massive divide in how you approach treating the disease. Like, are we looking at two completely different cellular mechanisms that just happen to cause similar outward symptoms? Or is there a hidden, unified link deep inside the cell architecture?
Exactly. And to solve a biological mystery that complex, you need a very specific kind of experimental model. You cannot just guess at the mechanism. So the researchers in the study utilized a highly specialized mouse model known as the Sanka G51D knock-in mouse.
Let's talk about why this specific mouse is such a big deal. Because they didn't just inject a mouse with toxic proteins or artificially overexpress a human gene in a way that overwhelms the animal's biology.
No, the design of the model is critical to trusting the data. In traditional transgenic models, scientists might force a mouse to pump out massive, unnatural amounts of a mutant protein.
Which probably causes all sorts of weird side effects, right?
Exactly. It can cause artificial side effects that don't reflect the real disease. But here, they use the knock-in technique. They introduced the G51D mutation, which is a known severe Parkinson's mutation found in humans, directly into the native mouse genome, right where the normal alpha-synuclein gene lives.
Which means the mouse naturally produces this mutant alpha-synuclein protein under its own internal biological clock.
Yes.
It expresses it at the normal times, in the normal amounts, and in the normal brain regions that a mouse would usually produce its healthy version of the protein.
And that native spatial and temporal expression is everything. Because of it, this mouse model practically mirrors the clinical progression of a human patient. It doesn't just start with tremors.
Right, it starts with the silent stuff.
Yes, it exhibits those early olfactory deficits, that early loss of smell. It shows early enteric or gastrointestinal dysfunction. And then much later in its lifespan, it develops age-dependent motor impairment as the toxic phosphorylated alpha-synuclein gradually accumulates in the brain over months.
It's basically a time lapse of the human condition.
It really is.
And to really see what was happening inside the brains of these mice, the research team deployed some incredibly sophisticated technology. First, they used something called RNAscope FISH. FISH stands for fluorescence in situ hybridization.
Yeah, it is a remarkable visualization tool. In conventional biology, you might grind up a piece of tissue to measure the total amount of RNA present, but you lose all the spatial context. You don't know which specific cell was producing what.
But with RNAscope, they are looking at the intact tissue. They use fluorescent probes that bind to specific sequences of messenger RNA.
Right. It basically allows them to light up and visually count the exact number of signaling RNA transcripts inside a single specific cell.
So if a support cell is preparing to make one of those supply drop proteins, the RNAscope lights up the genetic constructions like a constellation of stars.
Exactly. They can literally count the messages. It provides single cell, single molecule resolution.
That is wild.
And they paired that molecular precision with a spatial technique called 4X expansion microscopy.
I was reading the methodology on this, and I gotta say, I had to do a double take. They actually physically expanded the brain tissue.
They did. Yeah, it sounds crazy. But when trying to visualize incredibly dense, complicated structures, like the multi-ciliated olfactory sensory neurons in the nasal cavity standard light microscopes, hit a physical limit.
The structures are just simply too small.
Right, they're too small and packed too tightly together for the light waves to resolve them clearly.
So instead of trying to build a better magnifying glass, they made the object bigger.
Exactly the concept. They embed the biological tissue in a specialized, swellable polymer network. It's a hydrogel, chemically similar to the material used in baby diapers.
Wait, like actual baby diaper material?
Yep. They link the key proteins of the tissue directly to this polymer mesh. Then they add water. The hydrogel swells uniformly, physically pulling the tissue apart and expanding it to 4 times its original size in all directions.
Wow.
It enlarges the tissue while keeping all the cellular structures perfectly intact relative to one another. Suddenly, conventional microscopes can resolve incredibly fine, nanoscale details of the cilia that were previously impossible to see.
That is incredible, but I have to push back a little here, considering the immense effort involved. Why go through the trouble of genetically engineering a knock-in mouse, tracking it for a year, and chemically swelling its brain tissue in hydrogels? I mean, we have massive tissue banks of human postmortem brain samples from Parkinson's patients. Why not just look directly at the human brains to see if the cell towers are broken?
That's a fair question, but it all comes down to the dimension of time. When we look at postmortem human tissue, we are looking at the absolute end stage of a disease that has been ravaging the brain for decades.
Right. The damage is already done.
Exactly. The cellular architecture is devastated. The damage is so extensive that determining cause and effect becomes a biological guessing game. Like, did the cell lose its antenna because it was dying, or did it die because it lost its antenna?
Right. Chicken or the egg?
Precisely. By using the G51D mouse, researchers can study the dynamic timeline of the pathology. They can map how symptom progression corresponds to microscopic cellular changes at 3 months of age versus 9 months versus 12 months.
So that longitudinal view, seeing the crime in progress, is impossible with end-stage human tissue. You need to watch the dominoes fall, not just look at the pile on the floor.
Well said. And when they looked at this timeline, the findings were striking. They started their investigation in the dorsal striatum, which is a major processing hub in the brain, critical for motor control and movement planning.
Okay, and in the striatum, the massive network of dopaminergic neurons doesn't operate alone, right?
No, it is supported by specific, rare populations of local inner neurons and glial cells. The researchers focused heavily on cholinergic inner neurons, often called CHAT neurons, as well as parvalbumin, or PV, interneurons, and a specific population of astrocytes.
To put that in perspective, for anyone listening who has watched a loved one struggle with the physical symptoms of Parkinson's, these support cells are basically the unsung heroes of the motor system. They maintain the environment.
They do, and the researchers found that in the G51D mutant mice, these exact support cells were losing a massive amount of their primary cilia.
Oh, wow. So it's happening there, too.
Yes, and it wasn't a sudden overnight event. It started early, around 3 months of age, and worsened significantly as the mice aged to 12 months.
And the functional consequence of this physical loss of cilia was severe. And they proved it mechanistically, didn't they?
They did. Using that RNAscope technology, they measured the expression of a gene called PACH1. PACH1 is the direct downstream target gene for hedgehog signaling. If the antenna receives the signal, the cell writes the PACH1 RNA.
And in the mutant mice, there was a 30% drop in PACH1 transcripts.
Right. Because the physical antenna was gone, the chemical signal couldn't be received, and the intracellular machinery just ground to a halt. The distress beacons were failing.
And without that initial signal, the downstream supply drops stopped. The researchers observed severe, measurable drops in those vital neurotrophic factors. The CHAT neurons stopped producing GDNF.
The PV neurons stopped producing nerturin.
The astrocytes stopped producing BDNF. It was a direct, localized correlation. The specific cells that lost their primary cilia were the exact same cells failing to produce the neuroprotective factors.
So the motor system is essentially starving for support.
Now, if this cellular blackout is happening in the movement centers, it makes you wonder if the same thing is happening at the sensory front lines. Which brings us back to that very early non-motor symptom, the loss of smell.
Yeah, the researchers traced this pathway straight into the olfactory system to find out. They first looked at the piriform cortex, which is a region deeper in the brain essential for shaping odor responses and retaining odor memories.
And what do they find there?
In the mutant mice, the PV interneurons in this region had also suffered massive primary cilia loss, resulting in a staggering 50% reduction in their production of nerturin.
And they didn't stop at the cortex. They looked all the way out into the peripheral tissue of the nose itself, the olfactory epithelium.
Yes, and this is where that expansion microscopy became crucial. The nasal epithelium is incredibly complex. Interestingly, the primary olfactory sensory neurons, the actual cells detecting the chemical odorants in the air, they maintain their complex, multi-ciliated structure. Yeah. However, they found a critical failure in the horizontal basal stem cells.
Stem cells in the nose.
Yes. The olfactory tissue is exposed to the outside environment, so it gets damaged by toxins and viruses pretty frequently. The horizontal basal stem cells act as a reserve force.
I see.
They are single-ciliated cells that receive growth signals, prompting them to divide and regenerate the olfactory tissue when it gets damaged.
And in the mutant mice, these stem cells lost their primary cilia.
Exactly. Without those antennae, they are deaf to the growth signals. They lose the ability to regenerate the tissue.
So the tissue in the nose physically loses its ability to repair itself over time, while the processing centers deeper in the brain are simultaneously losing their neurotrophic support signals. It provides a stunning mechanical explanation for why the loss of smell happens so early in the disease process.
It really ties it all together beautifully.
But here's where it gets really interesting, because the researchers uncovered a massive paradox in how this toxic alpha-synuclein actually behaves in the brain.
Ah, yes, the synuclein paradox. It challenges a lot of our basic assumptions about cellular toxicity.
Right, so we established that the striatum has those rare CHAT and PV support cells, but they only make up a tiny fraction of the tissue. About 95% of the striatum is made up of a completely different type of cell called spiny projection neurons.
Right, these are the heavy lifters of the region.
And the researchers found that these abundant spiny projection neurons accumulated the absolute highest levels of the toxic phosphorylated alpha-synuclein. But despite being absolutely loaded with these toxic clumps, they kept their primary cilia.
It's fascinating. They appeared entirely resilient to the ciliary loss that was devastating the neighboring support cells, even though they carried a much heavier burden of the toxic protein.
It's like comparing these cells to different types of structures during a fire. The toxic alpha-synuclein is the fire. The abundant spiny projection neurons are like massive stone fortresses. They can get completely engulfed in the flames of this toxic protein, their interiors filling with smoke, but their fundamental structures, their cell towers, remain stubbornly standing.
That's a great way to picture it.
Meanwhile, the rare vital support cells, like the CHAT neurons, are like fragile wooden houses. Even a much smaller spark of the toxic protein burns them down and completely destroys their antenna.
That is a highly illustrative way to look at the selective vulnerability of brain tissue. But the analysis goes even deeper when we look strictly within the population of those vulnerable wooden cells. The researchers wanted to know if the presence of the toxic protein directly caused the loss of the antenna in the susceptible cells.
And they could see that with the RNA scope.
Yes. When they used RNAscope to look closely at just the CHAT neurons, they found a direct single-cell correlation.
Meaning, among those vulnerable cells, the specific individual neurons with the highest accumulation of toxic synuclein were definitively the ones that had lost their primary cilia.
Precisely. The toxic synuclein isn't just creating a generally poor environment in the neighborhood. Within the vulnerable populations, the accumulation of the toxic protein is intimately tied to the destruction of the cell's antenna. And this specific observation bridges a massive historical gap in our understanding of Parkinson's pathology.
So what does this all mean? We started out this whole discussion wondering if LRRK2 genetic mutations and alpha-synuclein protein clumps were two completely separate roads that just happened to lead to Parkinson's. But does this study imply the scientific community has actually found a universal bottleneck for the disease?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of neurodegenerative research, the data overwhelmingly suggests exactly that. This study is a landmark because it proves that whether Parkinson's disease is driven by inherited genetic mutations in the LRRK2 pathway or by the slow, toxic accumulation of alpha-synuclein in idiopathic cases, the pathology converges on a shared critical vulnerability.
The selective loss of primary cilia on these specific support cells and the resulting crash in the neurotrophic supply drops that keep dopamine neurons alive.
Exactly. It represents a unifying mechanism for the disease. And the clinical implications of this convergence for patients are incredibly profound.
How so?
Well, previous research by this team and others has already shown that if you administer LRRK2 inhibitor drugs to mice that have the genetic LRRK2 mutation, you can successfully prevent the loss of their primary cilia. You can restart the hedgehog signaling and bring back the neuroprotective supply drops.
Wait, let me make sure I'm getting the magnitude of this. Because they now share this exact same biological bottleneck. Does that mean a drug originally designed for a relatively rare genetic mutation might actually work for the vast majority of Parkinson's patients who just have the alpha-synuclein clumps?
That is the immense hope that this research points toward. Since both the genetic pathway and the toxic protein pathway ultimately destroy the cilia, deploying therapies that restore and protect the cilia could be a broadly applicable treatment for almost all Parkinson's patients, regardless of how their disease originated.
That is incredible news.
It is. But however, as with any major scientific leap, we must carefully consider the study's limitations.
Right. Science is never just a clean, closed book. What are the caveats here?
The primary limitation involves how the data was captured. The researchers measured ciliation in absolute terms, meaning they recorded whether the cilium was present or absent at a fixed frozen moment in time after the mouse was euthanized.
Okay.
But in a living, breathing brain, primary cilia are highly dynamic organelles. They are constantly reacting to their environment. They can change shape, shrink, or alter their length in response to physiological stress long before they completely disappear.
Oh, I see. So it's not just a simple on-off switch. There might be an intermediate state of cellular stress, like a flickering of the cell tower's power that we simply aren't seeing in these fixed static slides.
That is highly likely. The next logical crucial step for the field is to take those existing LRRK2 inhibitor drugs and test them directly on these G51D alpha-synuclein mice. We need to see if pharmacologically blocking LRRK2 can prevent or reverse the cilia loss in a model that mimics the idiopathic disease.
But thinking about that experiment raises a deep mechanical question. We know the LRRK2 mutation breaks the cilia. We now know the alpha-synuclein clumps break the cilia. Are they somehow working together inside the cell?
This raises an important question regarding the exact molecular trigger of the blackout. I mean, how does a clump of misfolded alpha-synuclein protein actually reach up and cause the physical antenna on the surface of the cell to collapse?
Do they have a theory on that?
One of the leading hypotheses involves the cell's waste disposal system.
Oh, the lysosomes.
Correct. The lysosomes act as cellular incinerators, breaking down waste. When toxic clumps of alpha-synuclein build up, they overwhelm the lysosomes, creating intense systemic lysosomal stress. The cell basically begins choking on its own uncleared proteins.
Like a microscopic garbage strike.
Exactly. And we know from other lines of molecular research that severe lysosomal stress can inappropriately activate the LRRK2 kinase enzyme. The kinase is a protein that modifies other proteins.
So wait, the working theory is that it has a domino effect.
Yeah. The alpha-synuclein aggregates cause the lysosomal stress. The distressed lysosomes hit a biochemical panic button, which turns on the normal LRRK2 enzymes. That hyperactive LRRK2 then chemically alters the microtubules that form the primary cilia, causing the whole antenna structure to collapse.
That is incredible. The synuclein pushes the LRRK2 domino, and the LRRK2 domino knocks down the cell tower.
And if that sequential hypothesis holds true in future drug trials, it provides rock-solid biological rationale for using LRRK2 inhibitors across a much broader global population of Parkinson's patients.
You know, it's incredible how mapping the microscopic antenna on a few rare support cells can completely reframe how we view an entire systemic disease. We've gone from looking at a silent, decades-long blackout of cell towers to potentially having the actual blueprint for turning the power back on.
It really is a massive shift.
And if Parkinson's disease is hiding this kind of universal cellular blackout, where the communication lines fall long before the cells actually die, it makes you wonder about other neurodegenerative diseases. Like, are Alzheimer's or ALS hiding their own broken antenna that we just haven't looked for yet because we've been too focused on the end-stage damage?
It forces a paradigm shift in how we approach neuroprotection entirely. It's a whole new frontier.
Parkinson's disease, whether triggered by genetic mutations or alpha-synuclein accumulation, converges on a shared cellular vulnerability. The loss of primary cilia on specific support cells, which strips dopamine neurons of their vital survival signals. Identifying this common bottleneck opens the door for therapies that could treat both genetic and idiopathic forms of the disease by restoring these cellular antenna. What does this mean for the future of targeted Parkinson's therapies?
Well, it means we are finally aiming at the root of the communication breakdown rather than just treating the silence that follows.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Hush of cells where the bright sparks run, tiny antennae fade one by one. Not every neighbor breaks the same. Some keep the light, some lose the flame. A misfolded whisper builds into weight, cuts the wire before the message can translate. When the doorway shuts, the garden goes dim, and the songs that heal can't reach the limb. Bring back the signal, let it come alive. Turn the key where the hidden pathways drive. If the cilia fall, we raise a new line. Find the thread of hope in a brittle design. Hold on, hear the precise.